Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During today's question-and-answer session, the command to ask a question will be star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to introduce your host for today's call, Mr. Rob Ahuja. Sir, you may begin.
Hello, and welcome, everyone. This is Rob Ahuja, and I'm your host for DB2 Chat with the Lab series. Our topic for today is latest in advanced performance diagnostics for DB2 on Linux, Unix, and Windows. Just to remind you before we get started that you can download the presentation for this chat by going to ibm.com/db2/labchats. That's LabChats. And without further ado, I'll pass it over to Sal Vella for an executive message. Sal is the Vice President of Database and Data Warehouse Development at IBM. Over to you, Sal.
I'm very happy to be hosting this DB2 Chat with the Labs. I want to thank everyone for joining us on this call. I also want to thank IDUG, the International DB2 Users Group, for getting the word out for this call. As we grow our business, it's important that we're also growing the community around our products. I want to take a couple of minutes to introduce you to some websites you should follow and some activities we have ongoing with our clients. Firstly, we have an active set of bloggers around our products. Some are IBMers, some are business partners, some are clients. To facilitate communication, we've created a blog aggregation site called PlanetDB2. So you can have one-stop shopping for blogs about DB2, which includes our warehouse offerings and associated IAM technologies such as streams and big data. Secondly, we have a number of videos around our products. Some of these are interviews with clients and partners. Some of these are educational webcasts. And some of these are marketing videos created by IBM and partners such as Intel. Again, we've created a single site for our community to meet. This is called Channel DB2. And it's a great source of informative and fun videos. Now, there's a lot of other activities that we have to promote community, and we have a big focus on education. One of the avenues here is the Chat with the Lab series, of which this is a part. It's a technical series where we feature webcasts and education for key topics. It can include things like performance with Steve Reese, PureScale with Matt Hurst, security with Waleed Rajabi. And this presentation is part of the series, and we've got a terrific success here. Frank Ning on the team has taken this concept one step further, and he's created a series specifically for the Greater China Group, which includes mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. And it's another growing community in an innovative way to reach clients in their native languages. Another very innovative way to reach users is dbtuniversity.com. And this is a site for online courses and uses the open source Moodle engine. And if you've got kids, chances are good that they're using the Moodle engine to manage their own online course loads. Now we've taken Moodle and actually ported DB2. So it uses DB2 as the back end, and in effect, we use our own technology for the site. And in this way, we're able to deliver courses in a very cost-effective way. And since the start of the year, we've had over 3,000 enrollments in these courses. One other tidbit here, several weeks ago, as you may have heard, the Amazon Cloud had issues, went down. And this site was also hosted there, but stayed up. It stayed up because of our HADR technology in the background. It's a really nice testament to our technology, even in cloud usage. Note that we also have the free version of DB2, called DB2 Express C, and the C stands for community. And we use this as a very affordable way for customers to start with DB2. We have thousands of downloads every week, and this is a great way for us to be able to reach growth geos and introduce our technology, allow people to move their applications over. Eventually, this turns into commercial application opportunities for us. This site is also great to be able to introduce new technologies to our customers. And over the past year or so, we focused on Data Studio tooling, made that available. And again, we've had thousands of downloads every week. And each of these is an introduction to additional technology, which will add value to our products. Now on to this Chat with the Labs. Recent releases of DB2, AEW, have continued introduce improved ways to monitor the performance of your system and uncover and solve performance problems. This presentation will review the gamut of performance tools that we offer in DB2, focusing on recent additions such as the new time spent metrics in DB2 9.7, new table functions to access monitor data, and the latest in DB2 PD options to see what's going on under the hood. The emphasis will be on practical use of these tools to solve typical performance problems. The presenter for this chat is Steve Reese. Steve is a senior manager and senior member of the DB2 performance team. Many thanks again, and enjoy the presentation.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon. Good day, everybody. My name is Steve Reese. I'm the manager of DB2 PureScale Performance at Lab here in Toronto. Very glad to be here today. I'd like to welcome everybody to the chat. I've got a lot of material here today. I've been in performance for 15 years, and that's given me quite a background of stuff I like to talk about, particularly around monitoring and tuning topics. And so I didn't have to be asked twice to give a chat on this topic today. So for today's agenda, I want to start off with a bit of a prelude about monitoring DB2. Is it a do-it-yourself, DIY kind of thing, or are you a GUI-interested kind of person? We're going to talk about that just for a little bit at the beginning. Then we're going to kick off. We're going to go from there into an overview of performance diagnostics in DB2 9.7. And we're going to talk a little bit about SQL monitoring, and I mean using the SQL table functions in 9.7, using those to monitor the database if you're a snapshot addicted person, how to make that transition in a smooth and painless way. And then we're going to spend probably about the last half of the talk talking about the big hitters, if you will, the key operational metrics within DB2 performance data that you would want to use on an operational kind of everyday way to keep track of what's going on in your system. And then we're going to go from there into drilling down into statement-level monitoring. After we summarize at the end of it, we'll have some time for Q&A, and I look forward to that if there's topics that come up that people would like to explore a little bit more. Okay, so goals for today, like I mentioned in the agenda, I want to help smooth the path from snapshots to SQL monitoring. I want to talk a bit about the big hitters, the performance metrics you really don't want to be without, and then provide some tips and tricks and best practices for tracking these big hitters in an efficient way. We're going to also provide some guidelines for reasonable values in both transactional and warehouse systems. So I'm not just going to toss out the metrics and say, go look at these. I'm trying to give some guidelines of the kind of values you might want to, that you might expect to see when the system is healthy or when there's a, performance problem has developed. And then we're going to show, pretty well all through the presentation, we're going to show examples and sample code to get you started. In fact, there's a lot of material here today, so if you're at all interested, I'd encourage you to download the PDF. In the appendix of the PDF is all the SQL in a nice cut and pasteable way that you can pull out and put it into a script and play around with it in your own environment. So before I get into sort of the nitty-gritty of DB2 monitoring itself, I want to talk a little bit about sort of a sneak peek of an upcoming chat that we're going to have on performance monitoring with Optum Performance Manager. So this is the issue about do it yourself, and DIY is fine, but you may prefer GUI, and there's lots of good reasons why a pre-assembled GUI approach can be really a big win. IBM Optum Performance Manager, you can think of this as the result of a whole bunch of really smart engineers that have got together, and they've kind of taken the kind of things we're going to talk about in this presentation today, and we've put it together into a powerful and intuitive and easy to use performance monitoring tool. That scales from being able to monitor just a small individual DB2 instance all the way up to monitoring an entire data center worth of DB2 systems. Because everybody doesn't have time to sit and watch all the metrics click by, of course, OPM provides the threshold and alert mechanisms to let the DBA know when a problem happens, either by email, et cetera, which really improves the efficiency of the whole mechanism. It also has a historical tracking and aggregation facility, kind of a performance data warehouse, you can think about it, where you can use that either to see kind of what's been going on in the past to compare what's happening today, or you can use it as well to trend out into the future to see how, see problems developing over time. As a companion tool to OPM is OPM Extended Insight, which provides some really sophisticated mechanisms for being able to measure end-to-end response time. And these are things, even including times outside DB2, which is a pretty, if you've ever tried to measure network time as a DBA, it can be a big challenge, and Extended Insight helps make that very easy. As well, Optum Query Tuner or OQT gives the capacity, the ability to be able to drill down into hardcore query performance issues, possibly around plan selection or individual indexing decisions or partitioning decisions in a DPF environment, et cetera, definitely a really powerful tool and a powerful suite of tools. So on the next page, page 7, we look at kind of the conceptual level of OPM, and it's sort of this cyclical four-step process. So initially, we would set up thresholds and alerts in OPM, what's my normal behavior, so that when problems occur, I get identified of the issue, and then from there we transition into a diagnose phase where we use OPM to drill down into problem detail and context, et cetera, analyze the captured data. And once that's done, and OPM can also help provide, as we move into the solve phase, provide some expert advice that's built into the tool to help resolve the problem. And last but not least, of course, we circle around to prevent, which is, of course, exploiting that captured repository performance data to trend out performance behavior into the future so that we can detect problems before they occur. So going down just a little bit more, and this I apologize for kind of the thumbnail size screenshots that are here, but I wanted to kind of make this four-step cycle of identify, diagnose, solve, and prevent just a little bit more concrete in terms of the kinds of things that you'd see. So we have, you know, at the identify level, we can identify, there's capacity to identify problems at the database level or response time or individual SQL. From there, when we go into the diagnose phase, there are many dashboards which present a very consumable representation of the performance metrics we're going to talk about today. And to help us lead into the solve phase, which might involve tuning the OS with some help from Tivoli or tuning SQL or modifying database parameters in order to achieve better performance. So, like I said at the beginning, we'll be having a chat sometime in the future on best practices for monitoring DB2 with OPM, and I hope if you're interested, you have the chance to join us. So I'm going to move on into this. We're going to now move into kind of the DIY phase. This is sort of when we're looking at the core performance metrics that are provided by DB2 itself. So we kind of have two different main categories of monitoring basics in DB2, sort of where are we now or how did we get here? And the where are we now is sort of the point in time. You can think of it, it's like snapshots. It's sort of a collection of where we are just at this moment. It could be a cumulative counters, those are the most common, counts of disk reads, total bytes read, et cetera, times, that kind of thing. Or it could be an instantaneous state. Like, for example, number of locks held currently, the state of the number of connections, or how many are committing, how many are waiting for client input, et cetera. It's a very, you know, like I say, it's a point in time kind of representation of what's going on. These tend to produce a smaller volume of data, typically lower overhead, useful for operational monitoring, and these are what we're going to focus on today. We only have an hour, and so we're going to focus on this. On the other half, how we got here, of course, are the traces, things like activity monitors, event monitors, CLI trace, and there's big news in version 9.7 on these as well. Hopefully, a topic for a future chat that we can go into this a bit more. But we're going to focus on the point in time metrics for today. So, what's new in DB2 monitoring? I'm here on page 11. So, goodbye snapshots, hello in-memory metrics. And goodbye has an asterisk next to it because they're not really going away. They're really being de-emphasized in favor of SQL interfaces to get to the monitoring data. There's a lot of enhancements in version 9.7 and 9.8 Pure Scale in the table functions and in min views. Lower overhead, really flexible and powerful collection and analysis by SQL, lots of new metrics. As well in 9.7, are new activity monitors. So these kind of, you can think of these as replacing things like statement event monitor, which is another form of trace rather than a point in time metric. Much lower overhead though in activity monitors than event monitors. Lots of new capabilities, including section actuals, which I'm just going to mention here as a teaser. If you're interested in section actuals, which is a count of rows that have gone through individual parts of an access plan, at the end of the presentation, there's an address. I've got a blog on the iDug site and, it talks a little bit more about that if you're interested. Okay, SQL monitoring for the snapshot addicted, the brave new world of SQL access performance data. So what are the downsides of snapshots? Well, they're great for ad hoc monitoring, the kind of thing where you just walk up to a terminal and you want to see what's going on right now, but really not so great for ongoing data collection. You've got to parse and store the snapshot data, and there can be lots of messy scripts involved in doing that. If you don't have those scripts, snapshots can be a little difficult to compare because they change formats, depending on the activity of the system, etc. And they also tend to be all or nothing. Give me absolutely everything that's going on in the system. I can't, pick and choose. Makes it a little bit of a challenge for regular monitoring. Table function wrappers for SQL access, they've been around for snapshots since version 8.2. It was a good introduction, but they were a little bit heavy-handed. They added some extra layers of processing. Sometimes the wrappers got out of sync with the snapshots, and so they weren't ideal. And so version 9.7 has really made a big improvement in that area. What's so great about SQL access to monitors? Well, first of all, you can pick and choose just the data you want. So, for example, you might want to pick up one or two elements or the whole table or any combination of them. You can store and access the data in its native form. Of course, DB2, we like to think, is pretty darn good at storing SQL-sourced data, so why not do that with the monitoring data as well? You can apply logic directly at collection time to warn of performance problems. I can do a simple range check on a parameter, and I can have it. I can use that as an indicator whether or not there's a problem. This is obviously the kind of thing that those bright guys over at Optum Development have done with OPM. Obviously, the same thing can be done with the snapshots with the SQL table functions, but it's a matter of a DIY exercise versus something that's done for you. And of course, you can also do all kinds of sophisticated data analysis on the fly or on the saved data. I can look at joining different data sources. I can do trending. I can do all this kind of data. The raw materials are there to do all of this. But I like snapshots. So what do I do? So first of all, snapshots are going to be around for a while. They're not going away. Not going away right away anyways. Good basic monitor reports, the kind of things that snapshots are also available now in new 9.7 6-pack 1 module called the Mon Report module. Now, if you haven't looked at this, this is quite a handy thing. So, basically, it gives me the ability to pull up a snapshot-like report that's collected over a given interval. The default is 10 seconds. So, I would call the stored procedure, for example, monreport.dbSummary. There's some examples down at the bottom, and it's going to 10 seconds later, it comes back with a report, a high-level report, fairly simple but useful stuff about what's going on in the system. And there's some examples on the next page here. So, for example, in the top left, this is on page 16, work volumes and throughput. So I have total application commits. I've got, these are kind of basic levels of activity, statements executed, CPU time, the level of activity of the system, both per second and for the total collection interval. Then there's wait times. Now, wait times are new in 9.7. This is really the time spent when DB2 couldn't do anything, when it was blocked on maybe waiting for disk or a lock or network, or that kind of thing. And there's a breakdown here of those kinds of things. So in the top right here, it shows that I have about a 70% wait time in the case that I took this DB summary. And so that means that 30% of the time DB2 was actually working, 70% of the time it was having to wait. And down below, it indicates that 88% of that wait time was spent waiting for direct reads out of the buffer pool. Well, that's actually off disk, but buffer pool reads. Down in the bottom right, we've got buffer pool statistics, our favorites in terms of hit ratios, but also showing logical and physical reads. And bottom left, we've got component times. Now, this is another powerful thing that's come along in 9.7, which is DB2, the monitoring information, giving me some idea of where it's spending its time when it is processing. So I've got section processing time. I've got things like compile processing time. So here it says, you'll notice 22% of my time in this particular case was spent compiling, which is quite a bit of time I might want to look into it and see why that was. Moving on to page 17, some tips to migrate to SQL access from snapshots. So first of all, the monitor switches that you might be used to, like buffer pool, statement, lock, all those are for snapshots. They're not related to the table function. There are two or three database configuration parameters that can control what's collected in the new system. Sometimes I have trouble remembering the name of a particular table function, or I want to know what's new in a new release of DB2. So I just ask the catalog. I do a select out of syscat.functions of the typical name prefixes mon and env, and I get a list of what's there. And from there, I can go into the information center and find out all about these if I want, or I can do more catalog queries to figure out what the arguments might be. Good idea when I'm pulling data out with monitor table functions is to include a timestamp, the time I collected this data. Most snapshots include that for free, and so we might not think of that right away, but it's a good practice to get into when you're pulling out SQL monitoring data. Grab the timestamp as well, because 10 minutes later, you're going to wonder when you got this data, and it's good to have that timestamp. You can do timestamp math as well, which is also very, very helpful. Last but not least, reset monitor. If you're used to being able to do reset monitor to zero out the counters and then do a snapshot, say, a minute later, that is a snapshot thing, again, kind of like the monitor switches. So the point-in-time data, SQL-based point-in-time data, is not affected by reset monitor. So what we recommend there is calculating delta values. You get an after and a before. You subtract the before from the after, and then you get the difference between the two. And I have a little bit more information on that on the next page. Page 8, actually, no, I'm going to get to that in a minute. I'm going to talk for a second about browsing, which is a little bit of a challenge as well. Some of the monitoring, SQL monitoring sources, they can be very, 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 very wide. They can be very, very wide, 100 columns. And it's a bit of a challenge to view it online if you just do select star. And so it can be handy to be able to turn it into a name-value pair. So you see what we've got here is we've turned the columns, we've turned the rows basically into column name-value pairs all the way down. So you can browse that information. How do we achieve that? Option number one, we can filter with a row-based table function. So one of these, for example, is mon format XML metrics by row. Quite a mouthful. Its purpose is to format the detailed monitor and event XML documents. So if I select, for example, I didn't get my highlighting here, so I'm going to have to go back. Okay, there we are. I called here mon get workload details. You see that in the second line of the SQL. That's going to return an XML document with some extra information, and I then call mon format XML metrics by row, and it will then give me, it enables me to get a kind of output that I've got here in the bottom half of the SQL, metric name and value pairs. And that's usable with any of the, quote, underscore detail table functions. Moving on to page 20, a second option, and this is not an official part of DB2. This is kind of a sample routine that we use here in the lab sometimes. It's called DB2 perf browse, and this basically lists the table or table function contents row by row, and it will take any table or table function, and so for the example I've got here, I called, select star from mon get workload, produces this enormous set of columns and data, and it's a little bit difficult to read, but I can pass that through this DB2 perf browse routine, and it gives me my column value pairs. So I can kind of page down through it. I can browse through it and read it almost like a snapshot. They're just column names rather than nice, English or translated versions, but it does make it quite a bit easier to consume the SQL monitoring output directly. On the next page, I've got just a somewhat bigger example of what the output of DB2 perf browse looks like. Okay, so here on page 22, we want to talk a little bit more about delta values. Now, we really need delta values and normalization. So on the left side, there's a section called Bad Math and My Car. So the average velocity, if anybody who's done basic physics, average speed is distance over time. So fine, my car is 9 years old, it's been driven 355,000 kilometers, so its average speed is 4.5 kilometers an hour. Well, anybody who drives a car knows that's, anybody who's driven around me knows that's nonsense. I go more than 4.5 kilometers an hour, and I could, so that average over the entire life of my car is pretty well meaningless, because pretty sure I went much faster than that sometime while I was in my car. On the right side, we see the same principle for database calculations. The average buffer pool hit ratio, good old, our simple friendly calculation here, logical reads minus physical reads over logical reads. Now, if my database, since the first activation shows, 1.5, is that ever, trillion logical reads and 34 billion physical reads, that gives me an average hit ratio of 97.8%, which I could be pretty happy with, but you never know what happened over that time. When the system was under heavy load, or maybe there was, a particularly busy day or a particularly slow day, or anything could have happened that might have changed the hit ratio at different points in time. And those are the things that I'm most interested in. So this is really kind of a bit of a commercial for the concept of calculating deltas. Now, what's a good way to do that? One way to find delta values is, well, first of all, we can create a table. Suppose I want to have these three field names out of mon-get-buffer-pool. Say, buffer pool name, pool data L reads, which is logical reads, and pool data P reads, which is physical reads. Suppose I want to have those three columns. I create a table that has those three columns plus a timestamp. And here's the SQL to do it, and I can insert directly into that, fetching out of mon-get-buffer-pool. So that's the first step. The next step is I take that same definition and I create two copies of it. I create a before and an after. Identical tables, but separate. One is going to hold data from the beginning of my interval and one from the end. And calculating the delta between those is as simple as, on the next page, creating a view over top of those two tables to calculate the deltas for me. So here at the bottom of the three rows, the one that labeled delta, I've got the timestamp, the change in time, the duration of my interval, the buffer pool name, and then the number of logical and physical reads that happened just during that interval. So now what I can do is once I have this infrastructure set up is I can insert monitor data into before and into after, and then I can just select the delta I want from the view. So one tip here is now I've just done it for these three metrics, buffer pool name, logical reads, physical reads. Next week, sure as anything, I'm going to want some more data, and I might have to create another one. So a good suggestion here is to just create something like that for the entire table function. Get everything once, get the deltas once, and then I can query against that to my heart's content, rather than having to create separate delta views over top. And as a by the way, there's a little note in the top right-hand corner here. There's another sample script mentioned in the appendix called, this says db2perf-browse. That was the last one, my mistake. It should actually be db2perf-delta, which is another an SQL routine, to calculate table function delta values. So, you know, if you're interested in this but don't want to go to the trouble of building this kind of thing yourself, you might want to have a look at that, and it can give you a head start. Okay, so that brings us to about the halfway point of the presentation. From here, we're going to go into looking at some of the values we can collect. Which ones should we collect? What kind of values should I expect in a transactional system or a warehouse system? And some tips and tricks along the way. So DB297 gives us typically three different angles on monitoring data. We can have it focused on data objects, so I can get data by buffer pool, by table space, by table, etc. I can get it by activity, sort of activity focused. What are monitoring statistics by SQL statement, by stored procedure call, that kind of thing. Or for the system as a whole, workload, service class, connection, etc. And these same three paradigms will show up as we go, as we query these tables. All right, at the very top level, something that you might be used to doing is getting a snapshot for database. It's a good, you know, how are things going overall kind of view of a system. So how do I get that in SQL monitoring? So a database snapshot is basically equivalent to summing up all the rows from any of these three, any one of these three table functions, any one of these three of mon-get workload, sum up over all the workloads, or sum up over all the service classes, or sum up over all the connections, is going to give me a pretty good picture of what's going on in the system. It doesn't really matter which of those you choose, because there's it's the three different views of the same data. Whichever makes the most sense in your environment, you can use. And of course, because database snapshot includes some really useful other, object kinds of data, throw in a little bit of extra mon-get buffer pool data, because database snapshot includes buffer pool rates, reads, et cetera, which I also find helpful. So that's a pretty good basic overall top-level view. Okay, we're going to go through a series of what I think of as really useful everyday metrics. This is more along the lines of operational monitoring versus digging into analyzing a problem. Hopefully this helps you detect the problem and solve the problem, but we can certainly go beyond this into traces and all kinds of things, but that's more than an hour's worth of chat time, and so we're going to stick to the snapshots for today, but this is a good set of metrics and target values that can be applicable in many kinds of systems. So first of all, we're going to look at buffer pool and prefetch quality. How well is my buffer pool behaving? Are my prefetchers doing good work for me? So these are a good place to start. So first of all, the first metric we want to look at, hit ratio. Can't do anything in monitoring without a hit ratio calculation. This is just logical reads minus physical reads over logical reads. Prefetch ratio is basically the fraction of physical reads that the prefetcher did for me. So in a transactional system, that's probably going to be zero, but that's natural for a transactional system. Whereas in a data warehouse system, you probably see something, you know, almost all the reads are prefetched. So it's going to depend on the kind of system where you see it, you know, in terms of what's normal for you. And then to finish off with a percent of unread prefetch pages. Well, that's just sometimes if prefetch size is you know, very large, for example, the prefetchers might kind of get ahead of a query, for example, might end up bringing in more pages than is necessary. And that's going to take up real estate in the buffer pool. It's going to use up space that we might better want, you know, might prefer to apply to something else. And so keeping in a little track of the percentage of unread prefetch pages is pretty good. Now, so what I'm doing for all these, this page is a good example. I'm just kind of talking conceptually about the calculations. On the next page here, here's the SQL. Now, I'm not going to crawl through the SQL in every one of these. Everybody can read SQL, or if you like, you can just cut and paste it. It's all in the appendix, cut and pasteable top to bottom, put it into a script and play around with it. But just to talk, unfortunately, there's some animations on this screen to move my little yellow arrow around from place to place, but they're not working in the chat. So just to describe sort of what's going on, we start off with picking up current timestamp. Like I said, we want to have the time. Buffer pool name, obviously pretty critical. And then we're going to do a data hit ratio calculation. The prefetch hit ratio calculation is about the middle third of the SQL. And then we've got the percentage of prefetch unread down at the bottom. And I'm pulling these all out from mon-get-buffer-pool. You see in the second line from the bottom, I'm calling that table function mon-get-buffer-pool to bring back the data for all buffer pools in the system. Now, you know, that's a bit of that goes by in a bit of a blaze. So after each one of these, I'm going to talk about some notes about the query itself. So first of all, like I said, timestamp included in each record because I want to know when it was picked up. There's a case clause used in the SQL in each case because, first of all, I want to avoid dividing by zero. For example, hit ratio, if there were no logical reads in the system, I don't want to divide by zero and cause a problem. It also helps filter out trivial cases. So I don't actually say don't divide if it's zero. I say don't divide if it's less than 1,000. If there's less than 1,000 logical reads going on, then basically the system is idle. And, you know, why would I panic about, you know, suppose there was two logical reads and one physical read, oh my goodness, that's a 50% hit ratio. Obviously, I don't want to be bothered with stuff like that. So I use this case statement to filter out the trivial cases. So I don't have to be bothered with that. For the SQL that I had on the previous page, it just talked about data, but obviously index, temp, and XML hit ratios can be combined or calculated separately depending on what's appropriate for your environment. Also exclude IBM System BP buffer pools. You know, they're there. There's, I think, four of them, one for each page size. And I'm not really interested in the hit ratio on those because they don't get used much. I'd much rather concentrate on the ones that are relevant to my system. This is another nice thing about using SQL is I can do that filtering out right at the beginning. I can just keep those things right out of the picture, keep it simplified and easier to use. Down at the bottom, I've got some ideas of desired ranges. On the left, transactional systems. On the right, complex query systems. And you know, everybody has a different idea of what's good and what's great. These are kind of just my opinion. So on the left side, I've got some ideas for data hit ratio, index hit ratio, what is good, what is great. On the right-hand side, for the complex query system, this is a bit more difficult because hit ratios are typically pretty poor in a complex query system because there's big scans going through, not much of a buffer pool hit ratio going on. So instead here, we focus on the temporary data hit ratio, temporary index hit ratio, if that applies in your environment. These are probably, if you're looking at hit ratios, these are the ones that you could focus on in a complex query environment. Prefetch ratio, conversely, on the transactional side, expect it to be pretty low. There's probably not much prefetching going on. Whereas on the complex query side, I want my prefetch ratio to be really high. I want my prefetchers out there doing those big scans for my agents so my agents don't have to do that I.O. themselves. And then some idea of an upper bound of unread prefetch pages, maybe 3 to 5% or less. If it gets much more than that, that seems to be a bit of a waste. Okay, moving on. Core activity. This is things like transactions, statements, rows read, these kinds of, you know, how is the system running? Is it busy? Is it idle? Is it somewhere in between? We're going to pick up total number of transactions executed, and that's, you know, we call that a unit of work, or a commit, or rollbacks could be included in there as well. Number of activities per unit of work, this is about transaction size. How big are my transactions? Are they, you know, just a few statements? Are they huge? That can have impacts on locking and all kinds of things. That's a good thing to keep in mind. Deadlocks per 1,000 units of work, and I'll get to in a minute why we do that 1,000 units of work instead of just one unit of work. And then rows read over rows returned. I am going to skip right by the SQL, and I'm going to go to the notes about the query itself. So the SQL that I've got here picks it up by workload, but you could also do service subclass, you could do connection, you could do, like I mentioned, with the three different angles of looking at the data, whatever's appropriate. The SQL in the example uses a roll-up, which is a pretty neat thing, because that'll give me per workload status, as well as at the overall system level. So I can see individual rows, and I can see it collapse up for the entire system, which is pretty handy. Deadlocks, in theory, shouldn't happen that much, which is why we normalize to 1,000 units of work. I could normalize per one unit of work, but then it might be something like, you know, 0.0001 deadlocks per unit of work, which is a little bit clumsy. So we'll say 1,000 units of work, or if in your environment 10,000 or 100,000 or 100 was more appropriate, then obviously that would work just as well. Rows read over rows returned is a very handy ratio, and that's basically giving me an idea of how much indexes are being used in the environment. So if I've got a really low rows read to rows returned ratio, that's a more of a transactional thing, and I would expect to see, you know, that's lots of index use, low number of rows read for rows returned for transactional, whereas in a complex query system, I would expect to be much higher because I could be scanning, you know, 100 million rows looking for the, you know, the Steve Reese credit card number. Hopefully nobody else is doing that. In terms of desired ranges, a lot of this really depends on the system. Total transactions depends on the system. Obviously, so does activities per unit of work, or what is basically a transaction size. On the transactional size side, it tends to be a little bit bigger. But do keep an eye out for a transaction size of 1, because that's kind of indicating that somebody is, you know, executing an SQL commit, execute SQL commit. Might be the way your system has to run, but that can be a little bit inefficient, and it might be by accident if somebody has left auto-commit turned on. In terms of deadlocks, on the transactional side, we tend to see deadlocks more frequently than on the complex query side, and then, of course, as I described earlier about rows read over rows selected. All right, disk and I.O. performance, another very key area that we want to keep an eye out for. Here we're fundamentally just going to do the count of I.O.s and the time taken. And we're going to do that for table space IOs. We're going to do that, and we're going to do that for log IOs. We're going to do kind of there's a lot of IO metrics in DB2, and you can break them out and slice and dice into little tiny pieces if that's appropriate or you're interested in that or that gives you value in your system. But what we're going to do here is we're going to kind of collapse things down to get just a simple buffer pool physical IO per unit of work. Total buffer pool reads plus writes divided by application commits. You know, in general, my system does this many IOs per transaction. And then it's the kind of thing that you keep an eye out. Did that change? What's happened if that changes? And then, of course, milliseconds per buffer pool physical IO is very key in case something is, you know, if something happens to go wrong with your storage and your IO time goes up, that can really slow down the database. And so keeping track of those times makes a whole bunch of sense. So we do that for buffer pool IO. You can do that for direct I.O. as well. Direct I.O. is things like long bar chars and lobs that don't go through the buffer pool. And so they're accounted for. They're counted separately. They're timed separately, et cetera. And one of my favorites, log I.O., transaction log I.O. per unit of work and milliseconds per log I.O. is kind of like one of my favorite metrics for a transactional system. Total log read and write time divided by total log reads and writes. Reads and read time are probably going to be very low in general. And then, so we're really looking at log write time predominantly. skipping through the SQL to the notes. Here we go. So, you know, currently, like I say, it's very high level. Currently, we roll together data and index and temporary physical reads, but we could keep them separate, and we could separate out XDA as well. Particularly in a warehouse environment, it makes a lot of sense to break out temporary temp table space reads and writes separately. And that's just good sense for that kind of an environment. We also separate buffer pool reads, which are done by agents and prefetchers, from buffer pool writes, which are done by agents and page cleaners, from Direct.io, which is non-buffer pool, as mentioned earlier on. Now, Direct.io, they're interesting things. They're these large, long varchars and lobs, large objects, are, you know, typically large. They're typically big, and that's why they don't go through the buffer pool. But direct IOs are actually counted in 512-byte sectors. So if I read, you know, a 4-kilobyte long long varchar or lob, a small one, say, at 4K, that would be 8. That's going to count as 8 direct IOs because it's 8 512-byte sectors. So we multiply in our statistics here. We multiply out to calculate time per 4 kilobytes. We're going to do things sort of by 8 direct IOs just to try to give a rough alignment with some of our other buffer pool IO metrics. Now, transaction log, this is an interesting one. It's available in a couple of places. I can get it from MonGet workload. There's a disk, the log disk wait time metric. I actually still prefer the value that comes from the admin view, SnapDB. So sysibmadm.snapdb.log write time. It's a little bit lower level, a little bit more precise to my way of thinking. Desired and typical ranges. This gets a little bit, and there's a lot of permutations and combinations here, so we're going to try and stick a little bit high level. Physical IO per unit of work in a transactional system, typically quite small. Hopefully you're working out of the buffer pool most of the time, not doing a lot of physical IO. If it gets a bunch higher, that could be because the transaction is large, or maybe it's because there's a hit ratio issue in the buffer pool. Hard to say. On the complex query side, we're doing a ton of physical IO generally. We're doing prefetcher bringing in a whole bunch of data and index reads, so typically the physical IO is high. In terms of time per buffer pool read and write, you know, just in general, we would expect writes to be a bit faster than reads, particularly if it's relatively small things. Once they get up into lobs, it's all bets are off. But for relatively small things, a write is faster than a read in general, particularly random ones, because I can, you know, the storage will dump it into cached memory and return quickly, which is a pretty fast operation, versus having to do, like on a transactional system, having to do a random IO, a seek, a read, all that kind of stuff, which typically takes more time. This is why our thresholds for good and great here are somewhat lower for writes than they are for reads. And also sequential or large direct IO as well, either like sequential IO in the complex query system or large IO for direct IOs, we would expect those to be faster. We're reading big chunks, but in terms of, you know, the amount that's coming in, if I'm doing a sequential read, the head's just moving along, hoovering up a lot of data for us, we would expect those times to be a little bit lower. Milliseconds per log write, under 6 milliseconds is not bad. Under 3 milliseconds is better. We want to shoot for low single digits, definitely. Now, this is probably a good time to mention, you know, the concept of normal for your system versus, you know, a rule of thumb that somebody like me comes up with. So these are just guidelines. They're a place to start, but you've got to kind of understand what's normal for your system and you know, have that in the back of your head, have it built into your script. If you're running OPM, have it built into your thresholds so that, you know, regardless of what's said in this presentation or some other presentation, you're tracking what's normal in your system. That'll help you most effectively find performance problems when they do occur. Okay, computational performance. This is things like sorting, SQL compilation, commits, catalog cache, those kinds of things that are kind of actual executing the statements down inside the engine. So the kind of things we're looking for here, percentage of sorts which spilled from the sort heap out to the temporary buffer pool or maybe out to disk. Percentage of total processing time spent in sorting. That's one of the time spent metrics. It's kind of been improved in 9.7. Percentage of total processing in SQL compilation, brand new in 9.7 and extremely handy. And package cache hit ratio, our old friend, telling us how effective our package cache is, package cache lookups minus inserts divided by lookups. Avoiding the SQL and going straight to the notes, there we are. So like I mentioned earlier on with the buffer pool stuff, we only calculate percents and averages if there's a reasonable amount of activity. So because ratios and percents and averages, they can be all over the place when the absolute numbers are low. So we try to ignore those cases. Sorts are an interesting thing. They can be very important. So we track them from a few different angles, the percentage of sorts that overflow, the percentage of time, and the average time per sort, because they can tell us different things about what's going on in the system. Of those three, I would say probably time spent sorting is one of the most important, because that's at a system level. You know, what's going on? Am I spending a lot of time sorting? And that's even more important than the number of spilled sorts, number of sorts that overflowed, because you can get lots of overflowed sorts, and if they stay in a temporary buffer pool, don't spill the disk, then it doesn't really hurt. You know, might not really hurt performance. Total compile time, like I said, is new in 9.7, percentage of based on that we calculate as a percentage. Now, this is getting into a bit of detail here, but most of the processing time that's reported in DB2 is under this thing called total section time, which is like execution time of an SQL section, obviously. Compile time is not part of execution. By definition, the compile has to come first, and then you can do the execution. So what we do is we do percentage of total request time instead of total section time. Total request time is really the end-to-end. It came in, I compiled, I did some other stuff, I got an agent, you know, all the different kinds of things that can happen, and then I execute it. Just in case you're wondering, you're looking at the SQL and you see a difference there. Desired or typical ranges for these kinds of things, again, spilled sorts, we hope, is going to be fairly low, but unless... You know, if it creeps up, I don't really worry about it too much unless sort time is high, too. That's on the transactional side. And the complex query side, of course, large sorts are typical, and they typically spill. So I would expect at least half my sorts to spill, or maybe more, maybe even all of them. More important, though, is the percentage of time spent sorting. So on the transactional side, if it started to get much higher than 5%, you know, I'd probably want to go look at indexing. I want to see, you know, what indexes can I throw at this workload to help reduce the amount of time spent sorting. On the complex query side, I have a higher threshold, but there's still probably a level at which, you know, if it's more than 25%, say, I probably want to have a look at what kind of joins are being used in my environment or indexing, et cetera. And if you've got the Optum tools, the OQT, Optum Query Tuner, can help you through with some of this analysis. Or if you're using the Configuration Advisor in DB2, that can help as well to figure out query issues. Percentage of time spent compiling. So on a transactional system, again, this is typically something that I'd want to see less than a percent, because we would expect relatively few compiles to be going on if it's a transactional system. In a complex query system, I would expect compilation to be less than 10%, but if it got much bigger than that, it could be because my queries are very complicated and they've got literals embedded in them to get the best, you know, selectivity and things like this, the best plan. If it's getting a lot higher than 10, maybe the optimization level is too high. Anyway, something to look at. If it gets, you know, beyond a certain level, you might want to look and see if this is how you really want to run things in your system. Package cache hit ratio, transactional, greater than 98%, something. It's a good thing to shoot for. But on the complex query side, typically we get ad hoc queries in, and we would usually, the package cache hit ratio in an ad hoc query environment can be really low, say less than 25%. Probably not something I would spend a lot of memory or time trying to improve. All right, second last one, wait times. Wait times are new in 9.7. Sort of this is the where are we spending non-processing time. The basic things we want to look at, the total wait time, the percentage of time spent waiting, so kind of two sides of the same coin. Breakdown of wait time into types. DB2 has a nice hierarchical breakdown of where it's spending waiting time. Am I waiting on locks, buffer pool I/O, or log I/O, or communication, or commit wait time? All kinds of things, little areas where we can be spending time. It's a great way of understanding what's going on in the system. And then, of course, count of lock waits, lock timeouts, deadlocks. Locking, of course, is a big potential culprit if you know, if I have kind of a lazy system, which is one that is kind of, you know, doesn't seem bottlenecked on CPU or on disk, but it's something's holding it up, Lox is definitely a prime candidate. And skip, there we go. In terms of notes on this, so a good breakdown of wait time categories. So there are lots of different wait time categories. The best breakdown of them is in the Information Center. The link, by the way, is in the speaker notes. If you download the material, there's actually a fair number of speaker notes all the way through the presentation, good extra little tidbits that you might want to be able to refer to. There's also, in terms of browsing wait times, there is a table function called monformat XML times by row, and looking at that, as I mentioned earlier on, for browsing, is a great way of browsing wait times as well, and it gives a nice kind of hierarchical summary of what's going on. An important piece of the wait time is the amount of time that DB2 spends waiting on the client, so it's the client idle wait time metric, and it's not part of total request time. Again, this is part of the whole hierarchy. So we calculate it as a ratio in the sense that, you know, for example, if I spend twice as much time waiting on the client as I do actually executing a request, that ratio would be 2-1. Obviously, we want that ratio to be as small as possible. You know, no time waiting on the client, 100% of DB2, get the job done as quickly as possible. So, individual wait times here, but they're reported as percent contributors rather than absolute. It's not super useful to me to see, well, I spend, you know, 5.237 seconds or something over a monitoring interval waiting for buffer pool IO. I'd rather know what fraction or what percentage of my total wait time is that piece. And then, you know, I just go for the top two or three largest wait times by percent and figure out how I can reduce those if I'm trying to reduce my overall wait time. And, of course, locking as a frequent cause of wait gets some special attention. So we track lock waits, lock timeouts, deadlocks, individually trying to get them the maximum amount of information about those. Desired and typical ranges. So I mentioned before about client idle wait time. Here, it really depends on the system. It's very variable. It can be as high as 2-10 times in a transactional system. Requests go by pretty quick, and we're back to the client and waiting for the next request. So you could spend, you know, 10 times or more as much time waiting on the client as you do actually processing inside DB2. On a complex query system, the ratio of client idle time to request time is usually pretty low because the system is typically pretty heavily loaded and is running hard on, you know, for example, a large query, something like that. Wait time as a percentage of request time, so it's how much time, what's the relative wait time versus request now. So this is the percent that I mentioned earlier on. So typically a 10 to 40%, depending on system load and tuning, is fairly typical. Disk I.O. time as a percent of total wait time. Now this one is often, disk I.O. and lock I.O. are probably the two big ones. In a well-tuned system, you'll probably find that disk I.O. is where you settle in at. You got to wait somewhere. If you're waiting, you got to wait somewhere. And it's probably going to be on disk I.O., unless it's on the client or the network or something like that. It can be quite high if other factors like locking log wait are under control. Lock wait time in a transactional system, typically looking for something like 10% or less. If it gets more than that, if it gets up to 20-30%, there's a new feature in 9.7 called currently committed that you might want to look into as a way of avoiding readers blocking on writers. Lock wait time in a complex query system is typically very low, you know, because we typically run at, we do relatively few updates, we don't take many heavy-duty locks, and sometimes we even run in a lower isolation level in order to avoid locking. Log disk wait time in a warehouse environment is generally going to be very low. Less than 5% might be even well less than that, might be less than 1%. In a transactional environment, the log disk, we could spend some time on this, but if we get above 20% or so, tuning of the logs might be required. Okay, this is our last section. We've gone through the system-level things. Now we're going to talk about drilling down, using the similar concepts to drill down into per-statement performance. So we're going to look at sort of top 20s, or you could do top 10s if you prefer, by CPU time, elapsed time, rows read, sort activity, wait time, etc. Lots of SQL here, fairly straightforward stuff. let's look at the notes on this. In terms of ranges, what's expected, very tricky to identify because it's going to depend on your system. So typically, we would identify problems at the system level and some of the previous ones we looked at, and then we would drill down into the statement level to actually try to resolve the problem. What we do is we do a number of queries here, a number of these top 20s, and we group some of the related metrics together. So in a single query, we might get, you know, activity, CPU, and wait times, or row counts and sorts, and these kinds of things that are logically related. You could get everything at once as well, which is fine, but the results can get kind of wide. So if kind of two different ways of doing it, keep it narrow and readable on the screen, or get everything in one go, up to you. So the buffer pool query, now we kind of sort this a little bit differently. So we get the top 20 statements for worst buffer pool hit ratio, but we're actually not going to order by hit ratio. We're going to order by physical reads because that's really where the time goes. So we change the ordering up a little bit on that. And having the same query with multiple different order bys, because we've got, you know, top 20 by this dimension and that dimension, et cetera, et cetera. If I have a statement that's number one in three different queries, in three of those different top 20 queries, that's a pretty good indication. You know, I'm getting some cross-referencing here to say, yeah, this statement is really pretty hot. It might be top CPU usage. It might be top I/O usage. It might be top in locking. It could be, you know, could be a whole bunch of things at once, which says, yeah, this is really the one I want to start with. All times in the SQL that I've reported so far are in milliseconds. Now, DB2 reports CPU in microseconds. That's its only exception to the kind of the millisecond time rule. But what we've done in these sample queries here is we've reported in milliseconds as well. So we report CPU twice, once in microseconds and once in milliseconds, so that it's directly comparable with wait times, processing times, etc. We also count both times per statement, which I can have one statement executed 1,000 times, so I can have counts and times and values that are per that statement, which means 1,000 executions, or I can also do it per execution. Kind of two different ways of looking at it, and sort of metaphorically you can think of, am I being crushed under boulders, you know, big, heavy SQL that even one execution is you know, a very heavy consumer of resource, or am I under a ton of sand? You know, a million executions, each of which is very small, but, you know, in aggregate, they're just as heavy as those boulders. And by looking at these two different views of the data, I can help see which of those things is happening. That's last step on the page here about the flow of statements to the package cache. So this data is all coming from a table function called mon-get package cache statement, which is basically giving me the contents of the package cache, both static and dynamic, which is really cool, new in 9.7. There is a flow of data through the flow of statements through the package cache. So good advice here is I'm going to end up issuing a whole bunch of these top 20 statements. Best thing to do, query mon-get package cache once, bring it out into a table. It could be some kind of temporary table, user table, whatever. Now I've got a consistent copy of it for all my queries so that I can, you know, make sure that from one query to the next, I'm seeing the same view. If I did multiple queries, you know, say I did 10 queries against mon-get package cache statement, there could be some changes in its content between executing my monitoring statements, and I might end up with something that seems a bit inconsistent. So, you know, word to the wise or a tip, bring out that information into a table for your analysis. Okay, almost the last thing. And then we'll get into the summary. So point-in-time information, there are some monitor views provided by 9.7 in the administrative schema. This is IBM ADM, dot, et cetera, kind of views, which gives summary and highlight information from the monitor table functions for me. Now, these are handy because I don't have to pass in any parameters. With the table functions, I generally have to pass in parameters and no parameters to these views. And they give me basic derived metrics. You know, hit ratio, I/O time, wait time percentages already provided. I've heard, you know, many people say over the years that wouldn't it be great if DB2 actually gave me hit ratio? Don't just give me logical reasons, physical reads. Give me hit ratio. Come on, do me a favor. And so this is a kind of a step, a small step in that direction. with these views, we get the we now start to get hit ratios and percentages that are helpful. Again, though, you know, for best accuracy, like I talked about earlier on, having the delta values is really key to getting accurate information. So, you know, best practice is still we do the before and after collection of data, calculate the deltas in between them to get the data as it is in the particular monitoring interval I'm interested in, rather than just since the time the database is activated. And there's a table at the bottom here that shows some of the different admin views and the stuff that's available from those. All right, so just to wrap up, and then we'll get to some questions. You know, we talked about do-it-yourself. We really spent most of the time today talking about the do-it-yourself mechanisms in DB2. But DIY or GUI, you know, we've pretty well got the whole thing covered here between DB2 and OPM. And as I mentioned before, we're planning a chat in coming up in the future sometime to look at OPM best practices for monitoring DB2. There is a whole bunch, you know, I've spent the whole presentation talking about a lot of things that are new in 9.7. There's a lot of improvements in monitoring, really revolutionary content here. Component processing and wait times, static SQL and SQL procedure monitoring, reduction in overhead in activity monitoring, which is those traces, but also in the point-in-time monitoring, and then the mon report modules, transitioning to snapshots, some snapshots to SQL using the mon report module. Pretty helpful stuff. A good set of monitor queries can make diagnosing problems so much easier, and that's either if you're in the DIY camp, that's you know maybe taking advantage of some of these queries that are in this presentation and building a set that are collecting operational data in your environment, or if you're more on the GUI side, you want to take advantage of the power of OPM in your environment. That's setting that up and setting the threshold to be to produce alerts when things start to go wrong. Typical performance workflow on the DIY side, anyways, looking at the DB297 metrics, we'd probably start off with the point-in-time system metrics, which is CPU and disk utilization. And we'd drill down just a little bit to the next level, which is top-level metrics such as buffer pool quality, prefetching, table space metrics, package cache, catalog cache, etc. And we've given queries, sample queries in the presentation here today that you can use for that. And then if there is a problem, and once the problem is identified, if it narrows down to a statement and not to a system-level tuning, we can go to statement-level metrics and break things down at a statement and per statement and per statement execution level. And that brings us to the end. I've gone a couple of minutes over, but we still have some time for questions. So, operator, if you'd like to open the lines, you can see if there's anybody who would like to ask questions.
Yes, sir. If anyone would like to ask a question at this time, please press *1. You'll be prompted to unmute your phone and record your name, as your name is required to introduce your question. Once again, *1 if you have a question. It'll just be a few moments while we wait for the first question. Our first question comes from, I believe the name was Rick Sefik. Your line is open.
No, it's Mike Sefik, but I just wanted to know if you have, can we get a copy of this presentation?
Hi, Mike. Yeah, certainly. It's ibm.com/db2/labchats, I believe. Just let me double check. ibm.com/db2/labchats.
Our next question comes from Yogi. Your line is open.
Hi. What does DIY stand for? That is
quick. Sorry, it's do it yourself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's all. Just a bit of a North American or maybe Western colloquialism.
Okay. And my question is, like, using this GUI or this tool, Optin solution, in SAP environment, is that recommended? Are people using it? How safe it is?
Oh, it's absolutely supported and recommended and used. In fact, one thing I didn't mention is that OPM has when it's being installed and set up, it has sort of configuration templates. You know, what kind of an environment are you running in? Is it transactional or is it a warehouse? And one of the categories is SAP. So, you know, the Optin tools have already been pre-configured to be able to be, you know, dropped in with an SAP template into that environment and have, you know, sort of appropriate level of monitoring already set.
Okay, and my follow-up question on that, because SAP is developing its own tool, SAP GUI, and they are trying to have all these issues addressed there. I could not find any note in SAP OSS Notes website that points me to use or like supported use of the Optim tool. So that's the reason I was checking online with you. So you are saying that, hey, people are using it with SAP system?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Okay, I will look further. Thank you.
Great.
Our next question comes from Ray Carruthers. Your line is open.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me? This is Roy Carruthers.
Hi, Roy. Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Just a general question. On the queries you put together, are any of those stored in any of the miscellaneous directories, or is there any future thought of adding those into the miscellaneous directories just so they're handy and available?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and we get feedback like that a fair bit. And so, you know, we definitely have plans of improving the samples and the quality, and well, not necessarily quality, it's already good quality, but there isn't much there in terms of samples. Yeah, so definitely, you know, kind of bringing these things into the samples is something we've got planned.
Okay, is there any other is there additional product you have to purchase, or is this all this part of base with DB2?
Well, I talked a little bit about OPM, the Optim Performance Tools, and those are separately licensed. But the bulk of the presentation that you're talking about, the monitor table functions and things like that, that's all right built into the product, right down to the bare metal.
And just to add, this is Rob, if you get the Advanced Enterprise Edition, then OPM is included as well.
Good point. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Chandra. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I wanted on slide 42, the percentage of time sorting, the percentage of time spent compiling. This is the percentage of the total request time. Is that what you're talking about?
That's a good point, too. And I mentioned the wait times, which is kind of the breakdown of the time spent waiting. But DB2 also has component times. And it's kind of, well, we take the other half of that, which is the processing time that DB2 is running, and then how does it break down? So there's compilation, there's sorting, there's different processing times that show up in there. So it, in terms of a request, you know, total, I believe it's request processing time. I'm not 100% sure of the actual name of the element, but yeah, you know, in principle, things like, you know, percent of time spent sorting, that's one of the component times that comes out of the overall request processing time.
Is there a difference between the request time and the activity time?
The request time and the activity time, a lot of the times they're identical. Now there can be a few times sort of corner cases where they can start to be different. Now, for example, I think one place where they can be different is if the connection concentrator is in use. So we have the request coming in, and then the activity itself doesn't actually start until the request is assigned to an agent. So there can be some differences between those, although, you know, in most cases you can probably treat them as basically the same thing. And the information center has a bunch of information about that in terms of exactly, you know, what the definitions of those are.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Next in queue is David Cicerano. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate the presentation. It was very helpful. My question was, I'm kind of new to 9.7, and I was wondering, do you have to turn on the monitor switches for most of these, or is there any new things that need to be turned on to take advantage of these SQL snapshots?
Ah, spectacular question. So it depends on if you're migrating a database, if you're upgrading a database from, say, 9.5 to 9.7, it'll kind of honor the current monitoring configuration that you have. So the new monitoring, I believe in migrated databases, is turned off, and I believe for new databases, it's turned on. So if you create a new database in 9.7, it's going to be turned on. There are reparameters. It's like object monitor object, monitor activity, monitor request. There's some others. They're down near the bottom of the database configuration. They have three values, most of them. They have off, which is collecting nothing. They have base, which is collecting most of the information, and then they have enhanced, extended. I can't remember the exact keyword, but there's basically three levels to these. And base is plenty good enough for essentially all of the queries that we've got here today, because really the queries we've got, we're kind of concentrating on the nitty-gritty core metrics that DB2 produces, and those are, as far as I know, they're all going to be produced at the base level of setting for those three monitoring configuration values.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Tamron. Your line is open.
Hi, Steve. This is a question about OPM. Is OPM going to be compatible with the Pure Scale?
Another excellent question. So first of all, most of the monitoring in Pure Scale, probably 80-90% range, is the same as monitoring in DB2EE or DPF. So things like locking and package cache hit ratio and, you know, buffer pools, you can treat all of that. All the metrics in EE are going to apply to Pure Scale as well. And then, of course, there's some additional things, obviously, going on in Pure Scale, which are, you know, an extension of beyond EE. And so in an upcoming version of OPM, OPM will be extended to pick up Pure Scale metrics as well. And so it's things like communications to the cluster caching facility, there are two levels of buffer pools in Pure Scale. There's a local buffer pool at each member. There's a group buffer pool at the cluster caching facility. So we've got a little bit more enhanced buffer pool hit ratio calculations, et cetera, and OPM is going to be extended to produce those metrics as well.
Thank you.
We have one additional question. I was not able to make out the name. So if you have queued up to ask a question, your line is now open.
Hi, this is Arthur Fleiss from Colgate. Is, based on your slides, do you consider SAP ECC a transactional or a complex query system?
That's a good question. Now, it's going to depend. I'm trying to remember the translation of ECC. I would say typically this, most SAP systems, you know, apart from BW, the Business Information Warehouse, apart from that, most of them are kind of, you know, they're leaning towards transactional. A lot of them are kind of, you know, hybrid. We'll end up with some transactions, some statements which are more complicated, they're going to be longer running, and then there's definitely in the underpinnings of the SAP system, the communications between the dialogue servers and the update servers through the queue tables, there's definitely an undercurrent of transactional work going on as well. So, you know, for the purposes of the presentation, I was kind of presenting the two extremes, you know, pure transactional versus pure warehouse, and a lot of systems, including various flavors of SAP, are going to be somewhere in the middle. So that gets back to the whole, you know, what's normal for your system, and then looking for deviations for that when, you know, problems occur. I don't know if that's helpful or not. Okay.
Our next question comes from Roger. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm relatively new to DB2. I have an Oracle background, so I'm trying to come up to speed on all the tools. OPM versus health monitor. Where's that going? Thank you.
OPM versus health monitor. So OPM as part of the tool suite, of the Optum tool suite, where we've got Optum Performance Manager, Extended Insights, OQT, the Optum Query Tuner, are, you know, very sophisticated, powerful tools. Now, there are elements of something like Health Monitor within OPM. There's certainly elements of that. There is a top-level dialogue in OPM where there are threshold indicators, alert indicators for kind of basic health metrics across the system, perhaps in terms of, you know, buffer pools or IOs, lock, et cetera. So there are definitely elements of that. But OPM as a tool itself, and then the Optum suite certainly go well beyond anything that we've done with the health monitor.
At this time, we have no other questions in queue.
Okay,
I think a few questions on the webcast, so perhaps you might want to go through some of them.
Yeah, sure. So we've had some questions added to the chat area here, so we'll just have a look for some of them here. Let me see. So one question, do we have a handy list? This comes from MF Chu, and it says, do we have a handy list of I.O. performance metrics in milliseconds, it says, disk types, I guess, between RDS and buffer pool, et cetera. So I guess these are looking for... Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I should have picked an easier question, I think. I'm not sure I completely understand what's going on here. But the I/O performance metrics, I think most of them that are externalized here. But like I said, there's quite a range of them in terms of buffer pool I/O, direct I/O, log I/O, etc. The performance metrics in terms of time are really. For random I/O, we're kind of looking for 5 to 15 milliseconds, I would say, is a reasonable target. If we're looking at something at more powerful disks, for example, solid-state disks or something like that, the disk times are going to come down a fair bit. I'm not sure if that really answers the question. It's probably off the mark a little bit. Maybe if there's a follow-up or a clarification, we can look for that. Okay, so here's a good question. When using SQL to monitor the SQL engine, what overhead is introduced and how are my results affected by my monitor SQL calls? Awesome question. That's from Jan Nelken. Thanks, Jan. That's an excellent question. Now, the snapshots, we go back in time to pre-9.7 or even to the 9.7. The snapshots are still supported today in 9.7. The overhead that we would typically see, there are exceptions, but we would expect something in the range of 5 to 10%. If you turn on all the monitor switches and you're using the snapshots in a regular basis, expect something in the range of 5 to 10%. There are certainly cases where it can go a little bit higher than that. In a very large system with a lot of connections, a snapshot can take, a whole bunch of time to collect data from, for example, 3,000 connections or something like that. So there are exceptions, but as a rule of thumb, say 5 to 10%. We go to the in-memory metrics in 9.7 and the collection capabilities that they have. The overhead, one of the main design goals when those were introduced was to reduce the overhead, both of the event monitors, the activity monitors that I just mentioned early on but haven't really talked about much, but also the table functions. So if I start to do the equivalent, so suppose I had a 5 to 10% overhead from snapshots, but did the equivalent monitoring using table functions, I would expect in the 2 to 4% range. So the overhead, round figures, is about half what it was now in using 9.7 and the SQL table functions as compared to snapshots. Okay, let's see. Lots of other questions here. Okay, good question here. How do I gather all these metrics for a period of time using the table function? Is the data in the snapshot tables kept for a certain duration? Can I issue function call referring to a timestamp range that I want the data for? So this kind of gets into, so now I'm starting to collect data and how do I analyze it? So basically, as I think for the example about deltas and data collection that I mentioned first, where we're creating our own table and we're going to do an insert into our own table, or tables, two of them, before and after, from the table function, that basically is bringing the data into my environment. Now, depending on what I'm doing with that, I can either, just keep dumping data in there. I can collect hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of rows over time, each of which hopefully has a timestamp, so that then I can do analysis, find me find me the lowest hit ratio I've experienced, in the last week by using, timestamp math on all that data. So basically, the short answer is it's up to me. It's up to you know, or up to who's ever collecting the data, what they want to do with it. So the table functions themselves, they produce the data and then it's gone. You know, they're like a data source. Once they've given you the data, you can't get it back from them. So if you want to keep it, best suggestion I can come up with is to bring it into a user table, and then that gives you the whole wide range of SQL processing that you can apply to that. Question, if some of these queries are 9.5 compatible, I think that's a good question as well, because the queries themselves, the actual SQL, not compatible with 9.5, because we're really focusing on 9.7 here. But the guidelines as to what's important and the guidelines of you know, good values versus great values, a lot of that, probably three-quarters of that, is definitely applicable to 9.5 and 9.1, because they're basic fundamental concepts. And even though the mechanisms for acquiring this data were a bit different in 9.5 and 9.1, et cetera, the data, most of it, not wait time and some of these new things, that's only 9.7, but obviously things like package cache hit ratio and sort activity and locks and all that kind of stuff is definitely available in 9.5, and you can apply the same principles there as well. Just scanning down through some of the questions here. So there's a question here, an interesting question about index usage. So it says, is there a history of plan usages used against SQL's run that which is being trapped by DB2 in some table? So it's basically, is there something somewhere in DB2 that's tracking usage of indexes? And that's been a very... That's a very common request. You know, how do I know if this index is being used? I don't want to maintain this index with, you know, I don't want to spend the cost of maintaining an index if it's not being used. How do I track that? And there, up until 9.7, there hasn't been a very good way of doing that. But we now have. I would call it a step in the right direction, which is a track of the last use time for an index. You know, since the To be honest, off the top of my head, I can't remember if it's, I don't believe it's since boot time. I think it's hardened in the catalog, but I'm not 100% sure. But in any case, it's kind of a step in the right direction of tracking the time. It doesn't say who, and it doesn't say what application, and it doesn't produce a list, all of which might be good and handy to have. But at least the last use timestamp gives you some indication if over time, you know, for example, if the system is up for an extended period of time or is operating for an extended period of time, you can go check that metric and see if the last time it was used. If it hasn't been used in ages, perhaps it's not being used at all. The question here is time waiting on the client, which is client idle wait time, like unit of work wait or connection idle time. Yes, so if you're familiar with an application snapshot, for example, if I get snapshot for applications and it shows all my, you know, current connections and what they're doing, and some of them might be in commit active, and some of them might be in lock wait, and some of them might be in unit of work executing. Well, some of them are probably in unit of work wait, which is the point at which we are now waiting for the next request from the client. And it's not necessarily between transactions. It doesn't mean that the application has committed, and we're now waiting on the next transaction to start. We're just somewhere between SQL requests. Question here, does OPM also work with in-memory metrics? It already works with some of them, and it's on its way to include more of them. And so there's new releases of OPM coming out. There's an update coming out. The next update coming out, which is coming out fairly shortly, is going to include even more of those. And so we have be able to take advantage of these extra metrics that 9.7 is providing. So a question from Paul Turpin, do any of the monitors give details about why a particular package is pushed out of the cache, like not used often enough, too large, et cetera? that's probably something more likely that would be in DB2PD, and I'm not even sure it's in there. So if you're not familiar with DB2PD, it's kind of the under-the-hood metrics of you know, being able to see what's going on inside DB2, not translated, kind of bare metal, lots of hexadecimal numbers in there and bit flags and stuff. But that's where you find out kind of really low-level things like this particular question. I'm not sure if it's there yet, but it'd be good to have a look, and that would be the place to check for it if it were available. Another question here: how do the tools like DB2PD and DB2Top compare to SQL-based monitoring? So DB2PD, I just mentioned DB2PD is kind of the low-level diagnostics. It does a lot of sort of functional diagnosis as well, but it also has some great performance content in it. It's a non-SQL interface. It's not translated. It can change from release to release. So it's one of those things that it's a little bit difficult to script in terms of, you know, having a script which pulls up DB2PD output and can use, you know, grep or sed or awk or whatever your favorite tools are, Rex, to pull it apart and pull out metrics. Because unlike snapshots are very, very consistent, you know, from release to release because they're intended to be consumed externally, whereas DB2PD is a little bit kind of straddling the internal-external boundary. DB2Top, really great tool. A lot of customers are very, very fond of it in terms of, you know, just give me the quick current, you know, real-time data that's coming out of the system. It's more of, you know, whereas DB2, we might compare DB2PD and the in-memory metrics or the table functions, DB2Top is kind of, you know, it's an interface for those, kind of like OPM is, except in the sense that OPM, frankly, has a whole bunch more smarts built into it than DB2Top does. DB2Top is a great thing for what it's, you know, for what it's used for, but in terms of you know, enterprise class monitoring and, you know, being able to set alerts and things, OPM has a much greater feature set. And I know there's a whole bunch of people that really like DB2Look, or I beg your pardon, DB2Top, and I might get some hate mail for saying that OPM has more stuff, but it does. Let's see. Does OPM work for DPF or EEE DB2 on multiple servers? Yes, it does. And OPM provides a view that gives a view across partitions, and it can also give a summarized view as well. So it is the DPF multi-partition support is definitely tightly integrated into OPM. Well, here's a good question. Can these SQL monitoring queries run on the HADR standby database? Now, that's an excellent question, and I don't have the answer to that. I suspect not. Even if it did, unfortunately, it would be monitoring the standby database rather than the primary database. And presumably, the primary database is the one that we're really interested in. So it's an interesting idea, but not sure if it's possible or if it would be useful if it was possible. Question here, is OPM supported only for 9.7? No, it's supported for it's definitely supported for earlier versions of DB2, and it is sensitive to the level of DB2 that's in use. So, for example, as it's being extended to include the in-memory metrics, the version, you know, as we get to new versions that are, you know, more powerful in that way, if you point them at a 9.5 database or a 9.1 database, they're aware that certain capabilities are not available on the older ones, and they're smart enough to, you know, still function correctly and work around those differences, and, you know, do the best they can to make up for the lack of information that maybe DB2 wasn't providing back in 9.1 or 9.5. Question here, DB2PD is reading data from memory structures. Very true. So DB2PD is kind of, think of it as a in computer science terms, sort of a dirty read of internal DB2 data structures. It's not latched. We go there, we grab it. If something goes wrong, DB2PD may fall over and fail if something changed underneath it. But the goal of DB2PD is to have an invisible footprint. It's like the cat burglar kind of monitoring tool. You know, it doesn't leave any footprints behind at all. Now, whereas snapshots and table functions are definitely latched. So, and what that means is, okay, the snapshot or the table function is going to go in. It's going to collect some data from the engine, and it basically grabs a token inside the engine and says, okay, I'm looking at these data structures. You can't change them while I'm looking at them, and then it releases the token. So in that way, there is some effect on the engine, some potential small effect when these latches or tokens, if you will, are taken and then released. So the in-memory metrics, yeah, they come from in-memory, but they're slightly heavier impact than something like DB2PD, which is designed to be, you know, as lightweight as possible. But also, I mean, if we don't, DB2PD potentially return data that's a little bit inconsistent. If it reads one value and then reads the next value, they might have changed in between. Whereas if that's read with the snapshot or the table function, if they're related, they're going to be latched and we get a consistent view of the two of them. So it's a little bit of a difference there.
Steve, I think there's still quite a few, but we are unfortunately out of time now. Thank you, Steve, for a great presentation. And a reminder to everyone that the recording of this webcast is available on chatgpt2.com in about a week or so. And, with that, we conclude this call for today. Thank you very much for attending.
This concludes
today. Thanks very much, everybody.
Excuse me, sir. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.